This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Everyone is burdened with the cost of owning and operating an automobile. And if you don't have an automobile, your access to employment and education and social opportunities is literally like a fourth or a third of what it is if you have a car, in terms of how many things you can get to in a certain amount of time.
Do you ever find yourself driving down a familiar street and suddenly encounter an unfamiliar right turn only sign that diverts all traffic off your intended route? The changing landscape of your city streets may be disconcerting and inconvenient, but there's usually a fair amount of thought and intentional planning behind those changes. This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn about how transportation planning can limit car traffic and even improve socioeconomic equity. We speak with Carter Rubin, a mobility and climate advocate for the NRDC, who discusses various efforts to make cities like Barcelona, San Francisco, and New York more livable for mass transit users, cyclists, and pedestrians. Take a listen, and maybe the next time you're unceremoniously diverted from a main thoroughfare, your annoyance will be mitigated by a pinch of appreciation. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Carter Rubin. He is a mobility and climate advocate for the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. Carter, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Last time we spoke, we were talking about e-scooters and their presence in cities around the country. But I'd like to tackle another urban issue with you, which is the campaign to eliminate or reduce car traffic in major cities around the country. So San Francisco is in the early stages of approving a project to eliminate all car traffic on one of its major thoroughfares, Market Street. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that effort first?
Yeah. So, as an Angeleno, I have the privilege of going up to visit San Francisco from time to time. And I inevitably find myself on Market Street because, as you said, it is the transportation corridor for San Francisco and the entire Bay Area. It is three levels of transportation infrastructure at street level. And then you've got the streetcars running underground. And then you have BART underneath all of that. And it is just this linchpin of the entire city. And it's also cuts a diagonal across the grid in a way that has always made it kind of terrible for driving vehicles on. And it was built and designed as a street way before cars were the presence they are in our cities. So the move that the movement that's developed over the last decade or so, kind of framing around this concept of a better Market Street, was really to rethink the amount of space that we give over to cars on Market Street. And whenever I'm up there in San Francisco, I'm just amazed that they ever let cars there in the first place. It's so overwhelmed with pedestrian activity and buses and bikes and streetcars. To me, it always seemed like a no-brainer, but as with anything, you have to make the case and build the argument. And what the city's rationale was in this effort was there are hundreds of thousands of people moving through Market Street, and just the tiniest amount of them are doing so in an automobile. And yet those small number of automobiles are just having this disproportionate impact on everyone else trying to get where they're going. Because buses and bikes and walking, they're all so much more space efficient. You can fit so many more of them going through a corridor than you can if people are trying to do that in automobiles.
Explain to me how that efficiency would be increased with buses only, because you still need to have traffic lights then, and pedestrians have to watch where they're going if there are buses coming through, right?
Right. So my understanding is that this will still look and feel like a regular street, but there will be restrictions that prevent vehicles from turning onto Market Street from side streets, I think except in off hours pertaining to deliveries for the businesses on the corridor. So as the city moves forward with constructing all these changes, what you'll see when it's all done is that this is a street that allows everyone to get where they're going a lot easier. And by restricting vehicle access, really opens up the street for a lot more other possibilities, both for transportation and for just being a person on a busy commercial street, sightseeing and watching and enjoying public space without the noise and pollution of automobiles.
And this includes rideshare vehicles like Uber and Lyft, right?
That's right. There will be some exceptions for taxis and commercial vehicles. I think they will be allowed to access the street for a very short distance and then have to turn off and not be allowed to travel through on Market Street.
And why don't you take a step back for us, Carter, and talk about some of the earlier efforts to eliminate cars. I'm thinking, for example, in universities and other smaller cities. When San Francisco's coming up with this, they're not coming up with an idea like this out of the blue, are they?
No. And in fact, the United States is, I would say, finally catching up to other cities in Europe and Latin America that have, you know, endured the experience of automobiles in cities for many decades and realized that in a lot of really busy destinations, the automobile is just incompatible with vibrant, healthy, safe streets. And a lot of this has to do with just the fundamental geometry of our cities. Places like Market Street or even downtown Los Angeles, Manhattan, these were cities that were laid out predating the automobile. And the grid of streets was really designed to serve pedestrians and streetcars and rail lines. And then if you look at Europe, they were built and laid out in the Middle Ages when everyone was traveling on foot and horseback. And so in some ways, the radical idea was introducing cars into these places in the first place. And now what we're just grappling with is decades of bad results that don't serve our climate and mobility and just like happiness goals. And so San Francisco is kind of joining the crowd. You know, domestically, we've got some good examples of car-free streets. Down in Santa Monica, the Third Street Promenade is an iconic shopping corridor that was pedestrianized in the 1960s. Parts of Times Square in New York are now pedestrianized. And we can talk a little bit about the work they're doing on 14th Street. Further in Paris, the Mayor Hidalgo helped kick cars off of a highway that runs along the Seine River. That was super controversial for a minute. And then everyone just realized how amazing it was to be a walker or a stroller or a roller along the city's iconic waterway. So it's really, I would say, a burgeoning movement across cities.
Yes, you mentioned how people push back for a minute, and anybody can imagine themselves driving along a road that they're used to driving, and then all of a sudden seeing a, you know, right turn only here, get off of this road. This happens from time to time if we live in big cities as they're starting to put more and more restrictions on vehicles, and it can be disconcerting. But like you said, once implemented, it usually makes sense. Are there any organized efforts to push back against these things, or are they mostly just cranky old people like myself?
So I think a lot of this has to do with a pretty fundamental fact of human psychology around loss aversion. And as people, you know, we are accustomed to things being a certain way, and we're really good at envisioning how bad it might feel if it changes, and can think very clearly about the things we think we might lose. And we tend to weigh that much more heavily against speculating about how things might be better. And especially when you're dealing with a thing like car-free streets. You know, we just cited a couple examples, but it's still a fairly new idea to most people. And so it's common when you're talking about removing vehicle traffic from a major corridor for people to wonder, you know, how am I going to travel if they're predominantly a driver through this corridor? Or if they're a business operator, they might wonder, how are my customers going to get here? And it's then harder to envision, you know, how much better might my business be with even more pedestrians walking up and down the street. So I think a really important lesson for advancing projects like this is that you need to collect good data about how people use the street to make the case that the cars are a fairly small share of traffic or the number of people moving through a place. On Market Street, I read from the city that there's like 500,000 people walking through the corridor every day. And so if you're talking to a coffee shop on Market Street, you can make the case, you know, drivers are not driving down to Market Street, parking at a meter, good luck finding one, and walking to your coffee shop. But what we could have is an environment where the sidewalk is a much calmer and quieter and safer place where people would want to stop and linger at a business like yours. Where you really need to engage, where cities really need to engage with stakeholders is around solving problems like access for people with mobility impairments who use wheelchairs, and access for things like commercial loading and deliveries that businesses can't do without. I think those are solvable problems. And if you're able to narrow the universe of concerns to those issues and really engage thoughtfully in how to ensure people of all abilities and ages can access the corridor and businesses can still have access to the commercial products that they need to sell, like, you can be successful there. At the end of the day, though, you need to build a movement of people who are supportive.
So Carter, when we look at classic European cities like Madrid or Hamburg or Oslo or Barcelona, we can understand how these type of urban planning policies could take off. You walk into little areas of Madrid and they're all built around a town square, and these cities are not built around the automobile like a lot of newer American cities are. So maybe you can give us some examples of cities in America that were built up more in the 20th century, built around suburbs, exurbs, and the vehicle, and what urban planners are doing to try to eliminate traffic flow and make it more pedestrian friendly.
It's tricky. You know, I guess part of my answer is that in almost every big American city, some chunk of it was built before the automobile was the predominant way that Americans got around. You know, New York and Boston, San Francisco, these are sort of iconically and obviously the cities that were built before the car was on the scene. But even LA, places like St. Louis, Houston, these are cities that have a core that really developed in the turn of the 20th century, pre-World War II. And so those are the places I would look to explore possibilities for how we could increase the pedestrianizing of streets and removing vehicle traffic or changing the way vehicles operate in cities. This is going to be a long-term movement to change the Americans' relationship with the automobile. And generally, strategically, you want to start where the case is the strongest, and, you know, look to the places that have tons of pedestrian activity already, where you can look at a street and see, wow, we really give over a lot of space to not that many automobiles, but we have all these pedestrians coming through. And then one way to try out these ideas is through temporary pilots. So in many cities, we now have things called, you know, Sunday streets in San Francisco, Ciclovia in Los Angeles, where you close down certain streets to cars and then open them up to everyone else on a temporary basis, typically for, you know, a summer weekend day. And the transformation is really remarkable. The first time I participated in a Ciclovia in Los Angeles was October 10th, 2010. So it was almost 9 years ago. And just the experience of standing in the middle of a busy downtown street and only hearing like people laughing and bike bells and music.
That's not very common to the Los Angeles experience, right?
No, it was like life-alteringly fun. It's hard to ever remember LA before we did that. And it's hard to think about the city the same way ever again, knowing that that's possible, that there's a way we could experience in LA, the 7,500 miles of streets, not from behind a wheel, flying by schools and parks at 40 miles an hour, but standing in the middle, convening with our fellow Angelenos.
So Barcelona has this concept that they're setting forth, the super block. Maybe you can explain that and then tell us if it could be a template to follow in the U.S.
Yeah, so Barcelona has a really interesting concept. I think they've rolled out in a like 9 or so block chunk of the city where they are closing off some of the smaller side streets to vehicle traffic and creating what they call super blocks that are these larger streets that still have car traffic, but the interior of these large blocks is pedestrianized. So streets have been reserved for pedestrians and bicyclists and even things like playgrounds and basketball. I mean, there's sort of endless things you can do in a street when there are no cars.
So it's turning those bigger streets almost into freeways.
Right. I think it's more about just trying to reorganize the street into different levels. And there are still some car streets and automobile streets. But there's a real focus on creating safe corridors and places for people who are not in automobiles. I think the results have been very promising. I think people really are gravitating to these new pedestrian places. And I think based on the public's will, there's a chance to scale this up even to an even larger extent of the city.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to mobility and climate advocate for the NRDC, Carter Rubin. So congestion pricing is an issue we've talked about here on Sea Change Radio before, and it's part and parcel with this discussion. But one of the things that is difficult to do in some of these cities, most notably I can think of like Los Angeles, is you have such income inequality and so many people are dependent on the vehicle. Maybe you can kind of address some of the equity issues that are being considered by urban planners as they continue to roll out new concepts for things like super blocks and other ways to not have the car dominate a city.
So you mentioned congestion pricing, which is this idea that we would charge drivers a certain amount of money to enter the most congested areas or busiest roads at the busiest times of day. And that works on the economic principle that some people will make a decision not to do that. They'll find another way of getting through that corridor, like taking transit, or they will go in a different direction to a less congested place or go to that place at a time of day when it's not as busy and the charges are not in effect. And that enough people will do that, you'll get enough cars off the road so that everyone who chooses to pay the fee will not experience any congestion. And this is a concept that has been implemented in London, Stockholm, Milan, and Singapore to great results in those respects. Up next is New York City, which has approved a plan to do congestion pricing in Lower Manhattan. And in especially the American context, equity and fairness in terms of race and socioeconomic status is a central question. And I would tell cities, do not even start talking about or thinking about congestion pricing unless you're prepared to center the needs of low income and people of color as part of your process. In New York, if you look at who travels into Manhattan, first of all, almost everyone's doing it on a train. and the people on trains are, a very diverse set of the population, and very few low-income people are driving into Manhattan at rush hour. Simply the cost of parking in Manhattan is exorbitant anyways, and the cost of owning and operating a vehicle in New York is exorbitant. And a social services nonprofit in New York ran the numbers and found that something like 99% of low-income people would benefit from congestion pricing because the buses and trains would move faster and get an infusion of revenue. And 1% or 2% would be burdened in some way. And when you're talking at that scale, it with a program that raises revenue, you can find ways to address the needs of those people. And then the question is, is New York transferable to other cities in the U.S.? And I think it's kind of obviously a pretty singular place, but I think there are some broad lessons and approaches that other cities can embrace. And I think one aspect of that is to start by gaining a really good understanding of who is traveling to the congested places at the busy times of day, and understanding their travel patterns. In a place like Los Angeles, where we think of the car as dominating, if you do look at the bus ridership and transit ridership in LA, the median household income of a bus rider in Los Angeles is $15,000 for the entire household.
What is that statistic a reflection of, in your estimation, Carter?
I think it tells us a lot about poverty in Los Angeles. But I think that is a group of people, and there's a million bus riders in the county a day, that would benefit tremendously from congestion pricing because they're on buses stuck in traffic. So you look at that and think, well, congestion pricing could be regressive because it could burden low-income households more so. But if you look at the universe of bus riders, it would be rather quite progressive. Where you really need to focus in is thinking about low-income drivers and their needs and how they travel around the region. And if, whatever the specifics of your program would be, are they going to burden a set of low-income drivers? And are there ways through rebates or transit subsidies or exemptions to reduce the burden and improve their mobility overall? And I would say, as a precondition for any kind of congestion pricing program, you need robust, high-capacity public transit.
Which LA doesn't really have, right?
Yeah, I would say we're getting there. We have a bus system that basically goes to every corner of the county, but it's pretty slow because it lacks dedicated lanes. And we've got a rail system that is growing, but is not as obviously mature and developed as New York or London.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Carter Rubin. He's a mobility and climate advocate for the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. So you have these inequities where you have kind of a 2 or 3 tiered system where the wealthiest are driving and the poorest are on buses. The challenge then would be to create a system that would level that playing field and not have the haves and the have-nots playing out in transportation, right?
Exactly. And in Los Angeles, the agency that is leading the current efforts to explore congestion pricing options is LA County Metro, which operates the trains and buses, as well as is a partner in managing the roads and freeways in the region. And the LA Metro Board, which is made up of local elected officials like Mayor Garcetti, as well as the county supervisors, in directing Metro to conduct the study, said this needs to be an equity study. Put that at the center. Let's not even think about congestion pricing if we're not thinking about how this could be a tool for improving mobility for people who currently are badly served by the status quo, which is that everyone is burdened with the cost of owning and operating an automobile, And if you don't have an automobile, your access to employment and education and social opportunities is literally like a fourth or a third of what it is if you have a car, in terms of how many things you can get to in a certain amount of time.
And so you mentioned the 14th Street busway that New York has implemented. Maybe you can kind of give our listeners who haven't checked it out yet a better idea of what it is.
Yeah, I mean, if you have ever wanted to see a bunch of jaded New Yorkers gushing effusively about their city and something that they didn't think was possible, you got to look up some videos on Twitter of people riding buses down 14th Street now that it is free of cars, or strolling and jaywalking freely through 14th Street.
And there's nothing better than jaywalking in New York, right?
Right. It's a birthright. You know, as there was discussions about potentially shutting down the L train into Manhattan, the city was looking at alternatives to improve public transit. The L train shutdown ended up not happening exactly as planned anyways, but they decided to move forward with this plan on 14th Street that would basically make it a bus priority street. And it opened a couple weeks ago. 14th Street is now reserved for buses only, and automobiles can access it for basically one block at a time to do just a pickup or drop off. And then they, you know, commercial vehicles and taxis have to turn off at the next opportunity. And just since then, buses are now getting through the corridor in 20 minutes instead of 30 minutes. The New York Times is calling it a phenomenal success. And I think most interestingly is they're not seeing any traffic changes on the side streets. And that was the biggest concern and sticking point for some members of the community, was this fear that, like, where are all these cars on 14th Street going to go? And what we found in New York, and we find in a lot of places, is like you can make changes and people adjust. And you can ask people what they did differently, and they might not even be able to tell you. But in aggregate, people adapt. And especially in a place like New York, where everyone's walking and taking transit anyways, you know, the cars went away. People drove different times of day, different locations, or just left the car at home. And the result is that there is this now, you know, miles of 14th Street serving way more people, way more efficiently than when there were cars on the street, because now the buses are moving faster, their ridership is increasing, and it's happening on these efficient vehicles where a lot of people can go go through on a bus to much greater numbers than would be if everyone had their own 200 square foot automobile surrounding them.
He is the mobility and climate advocate for the NRDC, Carter Rubin. Carter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Meters and Ronnie Hudson and the Street People.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.